Boy, joined once again by your favorite Santa Claus impersonator, Nick Acello. We are here for a special holiday edition of the Tailgate Podcast. Nick, how's it going?
I'm jolly. I'm fat. I have a little spot on my beard that's turning gray right now. Consider me fully in the Christmas spirit. Not only that, living with the girlfriend, obviously brag, but right outside my door, Steve Ocello is in town. Now, this is going to be airing on Christmas, so we'll be out of town by that point. But what a treat. Papa Steve coming in with the hot takes. He asked me just recently, like 30 minutes ago, I'm just grabbing lunch, and he's like, Nick, have you heard of this new drug called Trank? The streets are a mess right now. I'm like, Dad, get off Twitter and enjoy, like, find positivity. He's like, yeah, it's just these streets are a mess right now. And I'm like, you live in Montana. It's not going to affect you. So we're fully into the Christmas spirit here.
For the longtime loyal listeners of the Tailgate Podcast, you'll remember we called Steve Acello two Thanksgivings ago because we just needed a little bit of that gratefulness in our lives. So if he's unable to grab one of the AirPods and join in on this edition of the Tailgate, then make sure that you go into the archives. And there are some doozies in there. You get an appearance from Kathy Foy as well. And I'm looking forward to seeing the folks for the first time in a little bit here on Christmas Day. And that's why we're recording this, to drop on Christmas Day, because there's a ton of news to get to. We never really did like a full fall recap. You and I haven't been on the mics since mid-July, so there's a lot to go over. And Nick, you're the best host in the biz. Let's get us started.
What an insult to every host out there that's far better than me at their job. I mean, what a sampler platter that we have to choose from. I feel like every year I end up saying this, but wow, a lot happened during the off season. Can't believe it. What happened? The story for me, though, because it does hit close to home. I had two cousins, one on the men's side, one on the women's side, that played at this university, but Lindenwood. It is fast and furious. I'm doing one last job. I'm putting together a team for one last ride. RIP to their program after this year, and what a bummer. They provided some great moments over the couple couple seasons that we've been doing this, but unfortunately that coverage is going to have to stop, or we'll have to figure out some other way to bake Lindenwood into the shows. But Terry, what's going on with Lindenwood?
Yeah, so I want to say it was December 1st, roughly thereabouts, one of those Friday afternoon news dumps. The news broke that Lindenwood University, which had been NAIA as recently as, I believe, 2007, 2008, and then in 2021/22 had announced, and then in 21-22 executed the transition from NCAA Division II, where they had been since transitioning from NAIA to Division One. And on December 1st, they announced that they were dropping, I believe, 10 sports in total. This is a university that I think offers either 30 or 31 varsity sports, as well as 15, what they call SSA, which is kind of the internal athletic department, you know, sports with like formalized club organizations, but not NCAA sponsored, like rugby, cycling, that sort of thing. Lindenwood University has grown tremendously, significantly, and rapidly over the course of roughly 20 years, and athletics has been instrumental to that growth. And so this decision took me by surprise for a variety of reasons, but chiefly because it seems antithetical to the strategy that got them to this point. There hasn't been a ton of public commentary around what led to the decision. As is typically the case whenever a decision like this comes out, there's a frequently asked questions that gets published alongside of it. And there were two things that I took away. The first was that there was, to the extent that there was an explanation, it was, we're doing this for the long-term sustainability of the athletic department. And then I thought this was very curious, and I understand why they included it, but How do you, before I even share it, how do you determine long-term sustainability of the department? What does that actually mean when it hits your ears?
I mean, it means that athletics and the growth of the school are tied in with the money aspect of growing an institution like Lindenwood. Anytime you hear a news story, it generally involves money. So that's kind of where my mind goes first.
So wouldn't it strike you as odd if they said no amount of fundraising could undo this decision, which was another aspect of the frequently asked questions that was included and I found to be the most head scratching?
Incredibly odd. And unfortunately, the pessimist in me is I was like, somebody, you know, if we were to truly be able to follow the trail of dollars, if you say no amount of fun, you're telling me there's not a big enough blank check, then somebody is corrupt and something is going on.
Well, and so the reason that they, and it's not the first institution that has included that line in an announcement, is because what tends to happen when programs, specifically long established ones with large alumni bases, and Cal was the one that, you know, did this, Cal baseball, Cal rugby, got like a really strong negative reaction. We've seen it happen at Stanford, seen it happen at Brown. I remember it happened at Cleveland State when they added men's lacrosse. And at one point, the plan included dropping the men's wrestling program, but then subsequent fundraising efforts stepped up in order to save that program. And that's the point, is that essentially it becomes an alarm bell, chiefly for the alums and for every other supporter of the program, to say, we're not going to let this happen. And so you make that comment, no amount of fundraising is going to undo this decision, in order to try to cut that off at the knees. I think your point is well taken. If somebody were to walk in and say, you know, we'll put up $2 million in order to save men's lacrosse, or $10 million in order to save every, you know, all 10 sports, that would happen. I'm very, very, very confident in it. So the question that I have is what truly led to this? And, you know, I haven't read a ton about this, so I don't know the extent to which this is a little inside baseball, or, you know, just to use the expression, or whatever. But, you know, when I connect the tea leaves, there are a few things that happen in sequence that make me kind of squint a little bit, look a little, you know, side eye at the circumstances. So the first is, when the university made the announcement that they were going to transition from Division II to Division I, the announcement did not include ice hockey. And at the time, hockey was still a club sport. So that's the announcement goes out. There was a line in that frequently asked questions that corresponded with the announcement that they were going D1, saying, you know, will this affect varsity sports sponsorship? And the answer was no. We don't intend, or we don't expect, that this will, you know, affect any of the programs that are being sponsored. Again, this was like 2 years ago. There's a change in athletic director, and one of the first large-scale announcements, news events that occur after the new athletic director takes over for his predecessor, who had been the one that led the announcement that they were going D1, was a revision to the original plan that included hockey becoming a varsity sport. So Lindenwood men's ice hockey is now Division I and was not included in this recent round of cuts. And there's just something there that feels causal to me. And so, you know, I got to do a little bit more investigating, but that's how I understand it. We should add, to your point, one of the most important aspects of this is they are going to, at least at this point, it seems, play the 2024 season. It is intended to be one last ride. We've already seen their leading returning scorer transferring to Penn State. He'll be there for the spring. So they've lost their leading scorer for the season, which is going to be difficult for a team that, you know, struggled to score goals last year. But that being said, you know, a lot of guys on that team, kind of a lot of seniors playing for their last go, and then a lot of underclassmen, you know, trying to, it's kind of like NFL training camp, right? The preseason games where you're trying to put tape out there, you know, for the other 31 teams that you can then go to and try to find a job if you don't get one of the 53 roster spots at the end of August.
Yeah, and what I think is one of the most interesting things about this story, from like almost a player mindset personnel I feel like to the casual fan, or to someone who just kind of glances and breezes at a headline, they go, oh, well, you know, that sucks. And if they were to try and analyze how the players are going to react, they could say, oh, well, they're just going to mail it in. Like, what are they even playing for? Conversely, it's that quote from The Office where it's like, I wish we knew we were in the good old days while they were happening. It kind of forces that hand. And I expect this year for Lindenwood, regardless of the success on the field, to be one of the most uniquely fun seasons for anybody. Like, when the light is truly dark at the end of the tunnel, and you know there's not going to be another one coming, it makes you, and it kind of cherry picks those aspects. Because even when I was reflecting on the college career, we were always chasing that next game. And so when we lost in the quarterfinals of my senior year, semifinals, yeah, right, like we lost in the quarterfinals, could never be me. It kind of all came flooding and hit me at once. And then I was like, ah, you know, I should have probably appreciated the locker room a little more. Should have, you know, maybe spent a little more time. Not, you know, when I was upset and ran out of the locker room right after practice, I probably should have stuck around and, you know, clowned with the fellas a little bit. It forces their hand to enjoy every moment. And just, why wouldn't we go and play hard? So I don't expect Lindenwood's season to be on paper successful. I do expect it to be one of the most special seasons that any lacrosse team will have in the past decade, because this is kind of such a rare rug pull that what are we going to do? Sit here and cry? Or are we going to enjoy and savor every second? And then I actually have a question for you. Is there, like, if I find myself on Lindenwood's campus, is there a door that I can kick down? Is there somebody that I can kind of hold over the balcony, Wolf of Wall Street style? Who am I shaking down? Because I'm happy to play that role.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think being a party to violence is kind of a part of my job description for this podcast analyst co-host role that I'm in. I mean, I don't know. These things come down to university.
I just got a text from Terry characters. And he said, I'll call you after this episode. Okay, perfect. Sounds good. We'll handle that off
air. Chairman of the board. I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. It's a good question, Nick.
Awesome. Well,
the one thing I did want to add to your point, though, is that A, they get to basically live out the plot of Major League. So if you're under the age of 20 and you haven't seen that, go watch Major League. It's hysterical. And B, it reminds me of a lot of the stories that we heard come out of the practices after the COVID shutdown happened on that Wednesday and Thursday of that week, where basically all of a sudden it was like, our season's done. Fellas, like, we are not going to play on Saturday and you guys are going home, but we have an opportunity to have one more practice. And like the stories that came out of that one last practice, I think are going to end up creating some of the most memorable moments that, you know, high school and college lacrosse players that were a part of that season, you know, are going to carry with them for the rest of their lives.
And I truly hope that the coaching staff, yeah, ends up erring more on the side of longest yard when the guards flood the field and they go and, you know, play some schoolyard BS. I hope they err on that and give them like, all right, every Thursday's practice is going to end with 3-by or, you know, something like that. So that's a little tasty morsel for you. All right, moving on from Lindenwood. This was probably the most surprising news, and it's recent, and recency bias is very much a thing. Coddle the Navy. I didn't expect this. You tweeted that you audibly gasped when you saw this. I actually played for Coddle for a little bit under the Bayhawks, and he is all time. Like, he just walks with that aura of, I'm respected because of how I've done things over the course of my life. What were your initial reactions on Coddle to Navy?
All right, let me kind of lay out the course of events that led to this, because I think that that's the third stone that, you know, if you have the other two, you understand the Infinity Stone a little bit better. Did I use that analogy right? I'm not a Fantastic Four guy or whatever that we're talking about. So
we'll say yes, and I don't have enough time to explain how wrong that was, but yeah, nailed it.
Perfect. Stone number one, Jake Bernhardt, Maryland offensive coordinator, becomes the head coach of Colby College. The Colby job opened up over the summer, but they did not make a hire until the fall. And a variety of reasons for that, not necessarily pertinent or germane to this conversation, didn't leave Maryland in the best position relative to timing and bringing in a successor to Jake Bernhardt. Mike Phipps, Maryland alum, Navy offensive coordinator, had just come over to the yard from Georgetown, where he had been the offensive coordinator and the architect of you know, the Dan Beccaro, Jake Caraway teams, and then the team that ended up being the NCAA, the number two seed in the NCAA tournament 2 seasons ago. Mike Phipps, one of the most highly regarded offensive coordinators out there, long-standing relationship with John Tillman, doesn't have to move in order to take the job. You know, from what I understand, there was a little bit of a, you know, approach and kind of no thanks right away, and then maybe a little bit more of a re-engagement a week or two later. This Maryland opening, it was not quite a month, but, you know, or maybe it was open for about a month. And so as a result, you know, this is kind of one of those things that could potentially have a domino effect that just ripples around all of college lacrosse with these programs making these mid-year coaching changes, which are both not very common and also not very optimal. Joe Ample makes the decision to cut that off at the pass, and instead of hiring a sitting offensive coordinator, he goes out and gets what is the guy who's widely regarded as one of the most innovative offensive minds that the sport's seen over the last 30, 35, 40 years. Dave Cottle was the head coach. I mean, he's a Salisbury alum, made his bones in a meaningful way by leading Loyola to a level of prominence that the program hadn't previously had. If memory serves, they were the number one seed in the NCAA tournament in 1990. And then he led that program through becoming the head coach at Maryland, taking over for Dick Adell, and then led the Terps for, I believe, 11 seasons up through 2010, and then really threw himself into Major League Lacrosse and led the Chesapeake Bayhawks to, I want to say, 4 championships, maybe only 3. There's a little bit of confusion in there because Brennan Kelly was the head coach 1 year and Dave was his assistant. And then, like you said, you had an opportunity to play underneath him. It's a really, really interesting decision on a lot of fronts, but chiefly it's been 14 years since Dave Cottle was a college lacrosse coach, and it's been 30 some, maybe longer, since he was an assistant coach at the college level. It's a really substantial career move for him relative to, you know, kind of the normal trajectory of these things. He's peers with guys, you know, like Tony Seaman, who, you know, they didn't take this opportunity to get back into college coaching late in their career. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens because, you know, when I think of Dave Cottle, the tactician and the X's and O's guy, I mean, you know, I don't know for sure that this is true, but when I think of who invented the big little, so basically when an offensive player being covered by a short stick would have a pick set for him by somebody who was, or no, I screwed it up.
Close.
Did it backwards. Close. Did it backwards. Guy being guarded by a short stick sets a pick for a guy being guarded by a long stick with the intention of trying to get them to switch so that the player being guarded by the long stick now gets the opportunity to dodge a short stick. That's like the whole kind of general understanding of what the big little is. And effectively, at least as far as I understand it and concerned, Dave Cottle invented it. So, you know, we're talking about some of the most fundamental aspects of the game being attributable to this guy. And now, you know, he's got a Navy team that has a lot of talent on its roster. But also, you know, one of the things that's always kind of been the case for Navy offenses is that they're really interchangeable, meaning that there isn't necessarily like, you know, one or two guys who kind of rise above the rest. It's about, you know, the top nine offensively kind of finding their rhythm, getting their spots, and everything else that goes along with creating good offense. And so I'm just really interested in how that marriage of Navy's talent and Dave's tactical approach comes together and what it means for ultimately like their wins and losses on the field. You know, this is a program that hasn't met the level of success that they would have liked over the last couple seasons. You know, they want to beat Army and compete for spots in the Final Four and win national championships. You know, right now Army is the one on that side of the spectrum doing that, you know, coming a goal away from the Final Four last season. So, you know, they've got a standard and they want to meet it. And now Dave Cottle is the guy to help Joe Ample pursue it.
Well, one of the most interesting things that you just mentioned, and it was in passing, but I still think it was one of the most relevant things that I took as a player under him, was you briefly said, like, you know, it's about those nine guys kind of like blah, 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 finding their spots and then moving on. And what I loved about him was he took grand concepts and made them so simple for guys like myself to understand. And he really, I would say, trimmed the fat of what I was trying to do for the Bayhawks, because this was early in my career where I was still trusted to be an offensive player before they said, Nick, shoot the ball 50 yards over the cage and then get off, you idiot. And so what he did is, like, he would take me after practice for literally 3 minutes and just say, and he's a guy, when you talk, when he talks, like, you just kind of shut up and listen and try to absorb as much information. And he goes, yeah, Nick, don't be doing so much of X. Just kind of focus more on Y. And I'm like, all right, well, perfect. I'll go out there and do this. But he was doing that with every individual player, not only giving them the confidence where it's like, here's what you do it well, focus on this heading into the game. I do that. And then all of a sudden, like, three passes later, a guy is wide open on the crease. And talking to a couple teammates, they were like, oh yeah, you know, Cottle told me to just feed it over there. Or Cottle told me to make this, you know, very simple C cut. He kind of tactically took each individual one of us as a player, told us something very simple, told us one thing or two things that we were able to focus on that would just make things easier and simpler for us. But it was part of this grand tactical scheme where it would leave a guy wide open on the crease or a wide open step down. And so many of us were like, oh, holy shit. Like, you know, the vets were like, yeah, this is how he works. And this is what you'll eventually get to, you know, if you have a 10-year career. But Cottle's ability to do just exactly what you said, combine that with the amount of time that he'll have to develop, instill that confidence, refine it, fine tune it, trim the fat off of players' games that might be too ambitious or might be doing too much. Having them focus on one thing for a grander scheme is what I think he's done better than, you know, any other coach that I've ever had in my life. Even though it was a short period of time, he tells me one thing, it clicks, and then, you know, we're off to the races. So I think he's exactly what Navy needs, and I'm pumped.
Was the one thing he told you to do punch the opposing team's goalie?
No, that was years after. No, he was talking to me about the specific dodge that I had to my right hand, and he helped me refine my bull dodge as well. Because he was like, Nick, you're running in a straight line and just putting the crown of your helmet down. And I'm like, yeah, you should see what I can do with a punch. And he's like, shut up, you idiot. Take a step to your right and then come back and lean in and knock someone over. And I'm like, okay, I can do that. And then I did.
Okay, so that's really interesting. It kind of stepped on the next point that I was going to make, which I think was going to perfectly set up the segue into the next news item that I want to get to. But let me just make the point anyway, so I apologize for repeating myself. Well, what strikes me as must have having been interesting about coaching you as you progressed through high school to college to pro is basically you are So the value that you provide,
choose your next words carefully.
The value you provide is your versatility. So basically, you're what's the expression where a jack of all trades, master of none?
Yeah,
that's the way I think of you. At a certain level, thanks, you're an elite offensive player. But at the highest level, like there are 40 guys in the country or in the world that can shoot better than you. There are 30 that can dodge better than you, and there are 50 that can pass better than you, which is not a lot, but none of those guys, when you're playing professional lacrosse and there's like seven teams, yeah, that's too many. That's too many in order for you to be expected to do any of those things. But none of those guys can pretend to take faceoffs and then just try to push people after the faceoff as well as you can. And none of those people could guard the opposing guy who can do that shoot, pass, dodge thing as well. So that's why you were a really good high school player at Wheat Ridge and then a good player at Notre Dame, and then why you were a borderline player in the pros. But what's fascinating is that in order to be a good pro, you have to, I mean, in order to be good, like once you have good teammates, like you do have to find a role. And that's what's interesting, and that's what's particularly interesting for players who have really always only ever been asked to do everything. like, you're so much better than your teammates. Like, can you just go out there and do everything for us? And, you know, if there's one thing that we feel like we need more at the moment, maybe we'll ask you to do a little less of this in order to focus more on that. But, like, it's going to come down to your stamina and will, not your skill and quality. And what's interesting is, you know, again, this is just like a podcast made for you in terms of the topics and how close to home they are. But one of the biggest news stories of the month is an Alabama quarterback who decided that he wants to play lacrosse for Notre Dame, which I didn't know you were allowed to do. I thought you couldn't play football and lacrosse.
Per the NCAA, at Notre Dame, playing both with the academics, with the seasonal depression, there's no way anybody could do it. And it's illegal. And if you're just now tuning in, or if you don't know who I am, don't follow me on Twitter for your mental health, because I have this bit going about how you can't play both, which I did. And every so often, Terry, stupid shticks.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Your turn. Nope, your turn.
So, what were your college football opportunities coming out of high school?
I had the only two places that I...
Colorado School of Mines.
Had serious interest. No, they had interest in me, but I was like, I ain't no nerd. Meaning, I actually don't have the academic capabilities to get through your engineering school. But I played it off like, you guys are a bunch of nerds. I ain't going there. But really, I'm like, I'm stupid and I'm afraid. The Montana Grizzlies,
yep,
who were in the championship. And then Air Force. I could have played both legitimately at Air Force.
So you go to Notre Dame.
Quarterback.
Are you serious?
Yeah, they were looking at quarterback.
I mean, they probably have like 11 quarterbacks on the team every year, and then seven of them end up playing receiver and H-back, and each of them throws one pass over the course of the season so that they can
trick people. They're like, yeah, we're thinking about you as quarterback.
Exactly.
And that's exactly right. So, yeah.
So you play 4 years of lacrosse at Notre Dame, and then the following fall, after your fourth year of lacrosse, you played football?
Yeah, so that same semifinal loss, 2 days after that, I'm doing like the 40, the, you know, running routes, you know, high pointing balls, doing squats in front of the Notre Dame coaching staff. And if Notre Dame didn't work out, I actually would have done a fifth year at Montana. So
okay.
I had a backup plan.
So did you graduate? Had you graduated from Notre Dame at that point, or did you?
Yes, I was a graduate, and I was taking master's level economics courses.
How'd you do in those?
Not bad. Wait, this is just going off the rails now, but I wanted to like get some value out of it, because I was like, I know I'm going to have to get a job, and it would look better if I was taking decent courses as opposed to basket weaving for, you know, the potential Wall Street job that I was going to get and tap dance my way into. My friends were working on Wall Street at the time, and I was like, so like, how are the parties? And they're like, what do you mean parties? We're sitting in front of Excel sheets from, you know, 5 a.m. until midnight. I'm like, not doing that. But I still wanted to have a decent resume. So I applied without having the mathematic credits to the master's school for economics. And I talked to every one of my professors. I was taking like, you know, game theory, international trade, international finance, and then like cybersecurity in the modern world or whatever the schedule was. It was actually fascinating.
Yeah.
But I talked to the professors and I was like, I have one semester. I am not pursuing a master's degree, but I want to get some real utility out of it. So I am going to tell you that the answers that I get are going to be wrong mathematically, but I am very interested in kind of how everything works. And that's why I'm here. I'm probably going to try and squeak out of here with a C. The professors loved that. And on my international trade final, it was like, you know, here's how many migrants moved into Germany. What is going to be the impact on the labor force, and how many more cars is the German economy going to produce? And I was like, the German economy is going to produce negative 3.6 billion cars in the fiscal year 2016. And so I wrote this whole description where I was like, obviously Germany is not going to produce negative billions of cars. But given the factors, here's what I think is going, here's why I'm wrong mathematically, but here's like the theory behind it. And he ended up giving me like an 85 on the final. He was like, you're an idiot. Get out of here. Have fun. See ya. So it was a great year.
All right. So you went to the Fiesta Bowl, and then what happened?
I tackled Ezekiel Elliott. No, I didn't. It's the difference between elite college programs and just, I mean, we obviously were in the Fiesta Bowl. We were sick. But you look at the depth on Ohio State. It was me on the kickoff. And I was, you know, I don't know, Terry, would you say I'm a good athlete? And especially if I was at 235 with like 10% body fat?
Yeah.
Not like these guys. So this was that Ohio State team that was just so ridiculously stacked that like their kickoff teams are in the NFL type situations. And the guy I was going against, I knocked him down on the first one because I pretended to go juke and then like I knocked him down. I'm like, yeah, this is my field. On the next kickoff, I go to block him and I hit him. And the only thing I remember was seeing the stadium, the roof of the stadium in Phoenix. Lifted me up. And then not only did he do that, but like he kind of took my face mask and like gave me a couple like up and downs driving my head into it. And I was like, oh, this is real athletes. And credit to Buckner for you know, competing against guys like that for the last 3 years.
So Tyler Buckner is going to play lacrosse at Notre Dame. Apparently, I don't know. He's probably got to get some sort of NCAA waiver because, as you said, you're not allowed to do that. So Tyler Buckner was originally a member of the high school class of 2021. That was the last at the Bishop School in San Diego, California, La Jolla, to be specific. That was the last group that had commits before the rule change went into effect that ended early recruiting. So that rule went into effect on a Friday in April of 2017. Tyler, that weekend, had a visit scheduled for Michigan. There was some confusion when the rule announcement came out from the NCAA as to whether or not it went into effect immediately. There was going to be some sort of grace period or whatever. And so, you know, I've talked to John Paul about this story since it happened. And so Michigan compliance didn't know the answer. They were like, yeah, you know, we don't know. We don't know what, like, when you're going to have to stop having contact with these prospective student athletes, but he's coming. Go ahead and host the visit. It's fine. Whatever. So he hosted the visit. And then on Monday, there was clarity. It was like, no, this is now. Like, you can't talk to kids who are not in their junior, you know, it's not past September 1st of their junior year of high school. So Tyler Buckner called him on like Monday or Tuesday to commit. And he couldn't pick up the phone. John was like, it's the only commitment I have ever taken by voicemail. So that was Tyler's eighth grade spring. He went on to become one of the best quarterback prospects in the class. Played lacrosse as a freshman at Bishop's. Had some injuries. Didn't play as a sophomore. And then by the time junior year came around, he wasn't going to play because he was focused on football and subsequently committed to play Notre Dame football. The pandemic happened. Spring of his junior season didn't happen anyway. And then he enrolled at Notre Dame right around this time of his senior year of high school. So goes to Notre Dame, has like a pretty interesting season as a freshman. I think he had like, some ridiculous number of rushing yards because they would basically bring him on in like a running quarterback capacity. He wins the starting job heading into the fall of 22 and played decently well in that opening game against Ohio State. And then I can't remember, did he get injured versus Ohio State or the week later and miss the remainder of the season? And then Tommy Reese, the offensive coordinator from Notre Dame, goes to Alabama and Tyler Buckner transferred from Notre Dame to Alabama with him. Got an opportunity to start a game this season. Anybody who's watched college football during the fall of 2023 knows that Jalen Milroe lost and then regained the starting job and now has led Alabama to the college football playoff. So Tyler Buckner has clearly made the decision that, you know, for as incredible of an opportunity as to play high level college football and be a quarterback and a starting quarterback, both for one game at Alabama and I believe one or two games at Notre Dame, he wants to give lacrosse a shot. And now he's coming back. I believe he's got 2 years of eligibility left with the opportunity to appeal for a third. And he is set to graduate at the end of this spring. And he's moving back to South Bend after the Crimson Tide's football season comes to an end.
I mean, what a semester abroad. You know, some people go to London, some people go wherever. He decides that his semester abroad is going to be Alabama quarterback before coming home to the promised land. Two things. The first is social media is an absolute disaster for a number of reasons, but I don't think it gets any worse than transfer news or athletes whose careers didn't pan out as predicted. And what does predicted even mean? Oh, he's a good player. Let's see if he has success. Because I know seeing, you know, even just like little comments, because when I click to go retweet about how you can't play both in college and try and, you know, mousetrap people, these Alabama fans, Notre Dame fans, college football fans in general are like, this guy, you know, sucked. His career didn't pan out, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, seems to be going pretty well. He played for two elite college football programs, and now he gets a cherry on top of lacrosse. Regardless of the level of personal success, that to me is a fantastic career. And talk about jealousy. He got to be the starting quarterback for Alabama. Who cares how well you played? You probably had a little fun doing it. You know, starting quarterback for Notre Dame, probably less fun than Alabama, for being honest, but still a pretty good time. And then the second point, I was just talking about this earlier, but it's going to be interesting to see, you know, initially how he's utilized. And the mistake that I think people are going to make is they just think that you develop your IQ as a quarterback, you're going to be able to translate. People are going to assume that he's going to be able to make reads, he's going to be able to read defenses, he's going to have all these tools that you expect from quarterbacks. But I think that the overlap of how playing different sports is beneficial for you, I think that gap closes the higher and higher you get. When you're a kid, you should be playing every sport, because if you learn how to move in soccer, if you learn how to move in basketball, if you learn how to move, you're just learning how to move. So I think the mistake that people are going to make is assuming that Tyler Buchner's vision is going to be elite. And that's totally fine. I expect people to make that mistake. But what's interesting is I think one of the biggest advantages that you can take from playing high-level college football is in preparation. Because that was the biggest difference for me, was preparing for, I don't know, say Ohio State, preparing to shut them out in 2015. You have your game plan, you have your scouting report, you know it in depth. But I only knew 15 offensive plays and defensive structure. When I sat down for football, they handed me the defensive playbook, and just the pass coverage terms were about 250 that you needed to know off the back of your head. So I think that preparation gap and understanding a playbook and understanding what it takes to, you know, to succeed, I think that gap is going to be closed very quick, but it's still going to be a very completely different new sport, to the point where he's not just going to be able to tap dance his way onto the field. But I think his IQ growth is going to be significantly quicker than you might expect. Not because he knows how to read a defense, but because he knows what goes into preparing at an elite level. So my prediction is he's going to be a decent transition player. And if he gets a second year, he'll be a second line midfielder.
Interesting. Okay. Well, so I think that we're in a different position than we were a year ago, because we actually have an example of somebody who more or less just went through this with Ricky Miaison, who finished up his fall as a captain for Stanford as a linebacker, and then immediately transitioned and spent last spring with Virginia. I think your point is well taken relative to the difference in what you could expect from year one to year two. I think it's an absolute, I don't want to say it's like a travesty that Ricky Miaison didn't get another year of eligibility to play at UVA, but whatever. I mean, I was surprised. All that being said, I think that the biggest distinction is about what you're asked to do in transforming your body, depending on position on the field, as a football player. And I think that what Ricky was asked to add from a bulk standpoint, and the extent to which it affected his lateral quickness, was, I don't want to say it was more like damaging or destructive than I or somebody else with higher expectations or hopes for what he was going to end up doing would have hoped, because I don't think that's the case. I think it's more so just it was. I thought that you saw over the course of the year as he, it seemed like thinned out a little bit. I thought you saw the benefits of that in terms of specifically his offensive game. You know, he had a little bit more shake. Obviously, he was still able to truck stick guys, but whatever. With, especially when you compare it to, because, you know, in these cases, like, I have an image of what Ricky Maison was as a rising senior in high school. You know, I don't have that image of Tyler Buchner because we didn't see him after his freshman year in high school. But we did see him as a seventh, eighth grader and ninth grader as well. I don't think, what's interesting about this comparison is that they're roughly equivalent players. Like, you know, Ricky was the number one player in that ranking class as a rising senior. We never ranked Tyler's class because he was done by the time it would have gotten time for him to age. But it's very realistic that he would have been, if not number one, then top five. I mean, he was one of six players that committed before those recruiting rules changed. And I understand that's not a perfect correlation to who is going to be the best in the class, but it's a pretty strong correlation. So I don't think Tyler's going to have to do as much from the standpoint of his body that as Ricky did in order to get back to the lacrosse athlete he wanted to be. And so that is an asset and advantage. I think the processing that you're talking about is a really interesting conversation. I just read a book over the last couple of days about the Bragg. Yes, I know.
Sick Bragg.
About the creation of the air raid offense and Hal Mumme. And it's interesting relative to, you know, what I interpret that to mean as far as, you know, what Notre Dame or Alabama's quarterback would have had to have done over the course of the last three seasons from a processing standpoint. Just very different from how lacrosse players need to make decisions. Reading defenses in football is just so, so different from making decisions as a lacrosse player offensively. My expectation is that they're going to try to get him on the field as an offensive midfielder. As opposed to playing defense. I think there's better opportunity there. When you look at who they graduated, and then also I think, and you know, I had this conversation with Lars and Sean Kerwin with respect to Ricky, and you know, I haven't had it as directly with the Notre Dame staff. I've had it a little bit indirectly, but like, I think it's just easier. It's not easier. You can learn offense more quickly. You are less likely to be picked on, and the cost of your mistake is lower than if you put somebody on the defensive end of the field. So even though you might be able to best take advantage of his athleticism off the wings of faceoffs or in transition, I don't know that that's, I think that there's a realistic school of thought or a good school of thought that the risk for that is just too high. So I think he's going to be a second line midfielder, or at least competing for a spot on the second line out of the gate for Notre Dame. And you know, we'll see. Unfortunately, it's Notre Dame, so they're only going to play 12 games, and nine of them are going to be against really good teams, so there's not going to be a ton of garbage time. But hopefully we see early whether or not.
Okay. It's probably going to be a good amount of garbage time. You know, taking a peek at the schedule, I'm seeing a lot of blowouts, Terry. A lot of blowouts. Okay, so we've thoroughly covered the
Buckner
topic.
I understand why you would be a little, I mean, you're coming off of a national championship. I can imagine you're like, yeah, we're never going to get back there. But you think that Notre Dame's going to get blown out a lot this year?
Not so fast, my friend, to quote the great Lee Corso. Don't ever pull that mousetrap on me. Notre Dame's going to win by an average margin of 9 goals a game. Except for against Virginia, who it's going to be a one goal game no matter what, flip a coin. And watch your mouth about talking about Notre Dame before, you know, on that trip to Lindenwood where I'm kicking doors down. I don't know if I have your address, but I'll try to find it. Boy, am I just all talk. I just do a lot of this, push comes to shove. I'm like, Dad, help. So,
well, fortunately, he's close by. So
he is close by. And he was asking about how my reserves of ammunition are. And I'm like, I don't know, pretty good. Like, I just go to the gun range for fun and I hunt. We're not stocking up for the Civil War. And final point, there is a movie. There's two movies coming out. One is about the Civil War. And then the second is about the International Space Station that's watching a world war develop. and then each of the people have to take the ISS by any force necessary. I am begging my dad to watch those just so I can hear his commentary afterwards, where he's like, he's going to think he's watching a documentary.
Correct.
On that type of stuff.
Correct.
And I can't wait for it. So I want to quickly, and I'll just give you a chance to kind of recap, because I know you've already talked about it in depth with TD Ireland and Joe Nardella, but one of the big, everybody get pissed off, everybody take a dump in your pants, was the discussion about banning the clamp on the face-off for this. I don't know if it was this upcoming year. To be honest, Terry, I don't really care. I don't give a shit about it. But it's a hot-button issue, and all these unathletic, slow, weak-kneed Fogos who their only chance at being a college athlete is to win a clamp, lose the ground ball battle, and then waddle off the field. A lot of those types of people are very upset about it. So what were some of your takeaways talking with TD and Nardella about it?
So what I needed to hear from them was how big of a deal this was and how it compared to some of the prior conversations or prior rule changes that had happened, because in talking to some of their peers, it wasn't that uniform. The opinion wasn't that unanimous. There were some folks who were like, yeah, it's not that big of a deal. You know, the knee down moto grip ban was a much more substantial kind of change or whatever. They both reiterated that they think it's a really big deal. You know, it's important to point out, and I know you don't care, that this isn't a proposal and it is not for the 2024 season. This is a discussion that sets the table for next June's NCAA Rules Committee meeting, which would potentially vote on this type of issue. What are my takeaways? I mean, I think everybody assumes that this is, and by everybody, I mean kind of cynical fans, mostly on social media, that this is a precursor toward eventually phasing out the face-off. And talking to the folks who are promoting this and other changes, it's not. Like, they don't want to see the face-off go away. That's kind of the point. Like, the hope is that this would preserve the face-off, because we're taking out the things about it that we don't like in an effort to make the sport better and make sure that it doesn't go away. So, yeah.
All right. Now that we got through the face-off, now that we're doing the recap episode, we don't have to talk about it too much in depth, but I just wanted to give a shout out to Coach Corrigan and Wellner for winning head coach and assistant coach of the year. Way to get it done, fellas. Way to bring it back home. Congratulations. And it is Kevin Corrigan, not Will Corrigan, at Air Force. So let's just make sure that that distinction is made very, very clear. Congrats, Coach Kevin Corrigan. Will, you still got to earn your way. And congratulations to Wellner. Any thoughts on that at all, or can we just move on?
Yeah, I mean, I got a ton of thoughts, but to try to be as brief as possible, I think Kevin Corrigan is one of the best lacrosse coaches that the sport has had over the last 35 years. And I think that, you know, because his teams lost in the national championship game by a goal in overtime, and I think by two goals, a second time. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
No, I was severely concussed, so thanks for making fun of that.
Because of those two outcomes, there's a perception both that, I don't know, he was one of those, like, can't win the big one guys, I guess. And because, you know, I'll put it very simply. Because the perception was that Notre Dame was a team that won because of its defense and Jerry Byrne was a defensive coordinator. There was a strong perception that Jerry Byrne was the reason that Notre Dame was successful. And you know, his return coincided with when the program went from, you know, basically one kind of miraculous Final Four run to perennially competing for the Final Four, that he deserved a lot of that credit. And I'm not saying that Jerry Byrne wasn't incredibly instrumental to Notre Dame's success and deserves a lot of credit for it. What I am saying is that there was a certain percentage of the fan base, not the Notre Dame fan base, the lacrosse fan base, that undersold or undervalued Kevin Corrigan's contribution to that program over specifically, basically from 2006 to 2019. And I think winning a national championship, it's very reductive. The margins are so narrow. The quality of season one team had versus another is not reflected in the only team that won that, you know, on the final day had a good year. But as far as tamping down dumb criticisms, it goes a long way. And so I'm happy for him in that respect, and the way in which this is, you know, an individualized reflection of the perspective of the job that he did. What's interesting is that, you know, for Ryan Wellner to win assistant coach of the year is, in my opinion, even more of a no-brainer, because, you know, I think, and this is not meant to be critical, I think Ryan's contributions from the recruiting standpoint, you know, specifically through the transfer portal and the role that, you know, Brian Tevlin and Chris Fake and Chris Conlon and Jack Simmons had in that team and in that outcome was instrumental. And I think he gets, I think he deserves a tremendous percentage of the credit for the way in which Notre Dame has recruited the portal the last two, and now after the 24 season, 3 years. I've got to write this article at some point. You know, Ryan Wellner has more influence over the entire sport while having fewer people know and understand that than anybody else, right? The ratio of how influential he is versus how many people know who and how influential he is like as wide as it is for anybody in the game. And that's a really interesting, you know, kind of position for somebody to be in. So both deserving recipients, very happy for both of them. And, you know, it's always kind of like a nice little cherry on top of the sundae of reminding you of what happened 6 months ago, as far as a college lacrosse season is concerned, these coach of the year awards.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because I know that, me, the college teammate group chats, when, Coach Byrne departed for Harvard, we were extremely worried about what that meant on the defensive side of the ball. We were like, how could you ever replace a guy like that? And, you know, for Wellner, and, you know, credit to Coach Corrigan for, you know, assembling the staff and winning in spite of Ryder Garnsey being along for the ride. Boom, gotcha. It's been fascinating to watch that defense still, you know, be damn good. The supplements of the portal, like you just talked about. And, you know, here's a bit I'm working out in real time. You know, did Wellner essentially plagiarize the Coach Byrne defense? Wouldn't be the first case of plagiarizing going on at Harvard right now. Boom. Gotcha.
I think I didn't get that joke on like three different levels, but go ahead. Do you,
Kane? No, it was a, let me explain why that's funny. Cause
that's what every good joke requires.
No, all the news in Harvard about how their president plagiarized and all this stuff. And I just wanted to make a plagiarism joke. And that was the only thing that I could think of. So have you been keeping up with it?
But it happened at Notre Dame, not at Harvard.
Yeah.
Not the plagiarism, the defensive plagiarism would have happened in South Bend. Never mind. Go ahead.
Yeah. Good one, Nick. Really good stuff. So the final thing before,
hey, Nick,
before
you really need to get your, never mind. I can't say that. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. You're scared. That's why you can't continue that joke. The White House, speaking of hot
of topics that we need to avoid, yes, correct.
Yeah. Speaking of, drop in the comments below who you're going to vote for. No, so the White House endorsed the Haudenosaunee. The Olympics is its own, you know, nobody has a unique take on lacrosse being included in the Olympics. Wow, it's awesome. But it is cool, and it's worth talking about that as soon as that came out, the support for the Haudenosaunee and Six Nations to play as their own, you know, as their own team, it was immediate. As soon as it was announced, it was immediately followed up by this sport doesn't happen without them. It's their sport. We should be able to let them play. And at the very beginning, I mean, I'm in the same way that I'm cynical about politics and, you know, even like FIFA and the Olympics, I'm like, something as corrupt as the IOC, or, you know, as political or as, you know, the bureaucracy runs deep for things like this. And so I was like, there's going to be no way it ever picks up major steam. It's just going to be this fringe topic within lacrosse Twitter that never really picks up national steam. About a week after I had that thought, the White House and the Biden administration, it's funny with my dad right outside the door, I'm saying nice things about Biden, killed it. And they were like, this is fantastic. The Haudenosaunee need to represent themselves. So I kind of want to get your depth of knowledge in, like, what is the plausibility of this? Does the White House endorsing it have any pull? Is the bureaucracy in its own way? Predictions on how this plays out. And I don't think anybody has a more valuable opinion than you, only as it relates to this and nothing else.
So it's funny because I would actually argue the exact opposite of everything you just said. And let me go piece by piece. That's what makes us, this makes it a good show. It's why the people show up. Merry Christmas. So the first thing is to the cynicism, not unjustified. To the extent that it is unjustified, lacrosse just got into the Olympics, which the cynic would have said had no chance of happening for basically every year for the last 20 years. So my counter argument is, all right, well, if the power brokers managed to pull that off, however they managed to pull it off, then they earned some measure of credibility relative to, let's follow them with respect to this Haudenosaunee issue. And they've been pretty quiet on it, not silent, but pretty quiet. And the reason is because, and this is the second point, the IOC does not take being dictated to well. And that comes in every form, including the U.S. federal government. So I would say that the Biden administration's endorsement of the Haudenosaunee was fine, but the cynicism is actually probably more justified when it comes to being craven around the Biden administration trying to get positive headlines for their National Tribals Council, as opposed to their real support for the Haudenosaunee participating in the 2028 Olympics. It's not to say that they don't want it to happen, but it's to say that, you know, is if they really did want it to happen, does a is a public endorsement the best or most substantial thing they could do in order to try to bring about the outcome? So the thing that I took from World Lacrosse's and the Haudenosaunee Lacrosse leadership's response that was more significant than anything else was that a lot of the similar phrasing was in each of their statements, particularly around the idea of working within and respecting the existing IOC rule set and infrastructure. And that speaks to two things to me. A measure of deference for understanding that, like, because the IOC won't be dictated to, we have to come to an amenable solution with them. Like, they're hosting the party. We don't get to dictate the terms of their party to them. So let's just figure it out. And let's do that by being respectful, because that is what we have experienced or we know works with the IOC. And then the second is the Haudenosaunee leadership's participation in that tells me that they are working closely with World Lacrosse in this approach. And I think that's important for lacrosse fans and specifically lacrosse players to hear and know, because the notion of if the Haudenosaunee can't play, lacrosse should boycott the 28 Olympics, whatever, like using firebrand language like that isn't going to help the Haudenosaunee play, even if it is the way that we all feel, right? So it's like that one of those things where, like, we can all know implicitly that that is what should happen if that outcome occurs, but to say it actively decreases the likelihood of the optimal outcome. So just let it be the quiet secret, and then if it's, you know, July 21st, 2028 or whatever the day before the Olympics is and the Haudenosaunee aren't included, then you make the final decision. But over the course
of the next 5 years, that's exactly what I thought.
Let's
that's I thought it was so stupid that the analogy that you just used of the IOC is hosting the party. Lacrosse finally gets the invite. And then all of a sudden, people, again, social media, so it's not real life or anything, they go, we're not coming to your party unless my buddy can join. And it's like, dude, you've been begging to get into this party for 10 years. How about you just, we work out the invite without you, you know, threatening to, you know,
especially when
threatening to boycott.
Especially when you have this really, like, valuable kind of thing, which is, hey, like, we really appreciate the invitation. Can't wait to be there. We're all about it. Also, we've got this friend. He didn't get an invite, sort of, kind of, but you're going to love him, and he's going to contribute so much to the party. Like, let's figure out a way to get him an invitation. Like, we have 5 years to do that, right? It's not going to be the NOC route. I don't think there's enough time for that. It's going to require some level of exemption. But there have been numerous exemptions, not just the most high profile, like the athletes from Russia or, you know, the athletes representing the refugee team. I mean, one of the examples that I found really interesting was at the Pyeongchang Olympics. There was a joint North-South Korea hockey team. That's not a nation state that represents or that can compete under its own flag, but it was a team that for pretty, I guess, lack of a better way of putting it, obvious reasons, there was a compelling reason to have that team participate at that particular games. And this is not comparable from a geopolitical standpoint, but it is from the standpoint of an exemption for a team to be able to participate at a particular games in a particular sport. Let's make it happen. And especially because, and I've said this before, but I'm going to say it every single time this comes up. This is not me saying it. This is, you know, Leo Nolan and Rex Lyons and Oren Lyons and Jeremy Thompson and, you know, so many other folks that I have spoken to. If they're able to march and compete under their own flag, it will be such a transcendent moment for this people from a lacrosse standpoint and from a governmental sovereignty standpoint that all of the necessary sacrifices, including keeping the quiet part, the secret for a little bit longer, are worth making. Because if that's the benefit, if that's the positive outcome, then not saying we're going to boycott for like 2 years is not a hard sacrifice.
It's like, to use the party analogy, the cops knock at the door and just everybody just shut up for a little bit. And then we can all get what we want if we just shut up for a little bit. But, you know,
that's an unbelievably good analogy. We're just turning the music off for like an hour. Not even an hour.
But it's my favorite song.
Turn the music off for like 10 minutes.
Yeah, just hit skip. No, that's my favorite song. Well, your song sucks, so why don't you stop singing it? I think it goes back to mass human psychology and what social media has done to the development of the human brain. All of us are meant to be in caves, eating berries, hunting buffalo, and yet here we are connected to the world, threatening to boycott the Olympics over something that hasn't happened yet. Again, I live with my girlfriend. Oh, you're in trouble for something that hasn't happened yet? Well, maybe just give it a little time. Give it a little time. Keep your mouth shut. Have a little chocolate. Have a snack. Have a hot toddy.
It's that time of year.
That one's free. Next one will cost you. Dr. Nick, you know, going to be a recurring bit. So that was fantastically insightful. And I don't know if I should tell you this or if I have told you. A lot of the times, which is detrimental to society in general, a lot of times I'm kind of viewed as a source for how people get their information. Like even just, you know, in Idaho, hey, Nick, what do you think of this? And I just make something up. Hey, Nick, what do you think of lacrosse in the Olympics in the Haudenosaunee? And I'm like, yep, might happen, might not. And they're like, wow, that's insightful. And now I am just going to recite exactly what you just said and make it my own and say, well, actually, you know, boycott and, you know, everybody just keep quiet. And within the IOC, North and South Korea, hockey team, blah, 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 and I get to sound smarter. So thank you for giving me that knowledge that I then get a pawn off as my own. So
there's a lot to talk about. Are we going to keep going? I mean, if we do, we're going to have to pick up the pace.
We're just going to pick up the pace and we're going to cruise through this because it's kind of like another overarching question that you get to decide how much time we're going to spend on each individual program slash team.
Well, and people know how concise I am. So this is definitely going to 1-2 minutes on each question tops.
One of my favorite things about you is how concise. So you spent a lot of time on the road this fall looking at programs. I mean, every time I would text you, you're like, oh, you know, I'm on the road, you know, trying to stop at Popeye's Chicken or, you know, stopping at Chick-fil-A, whatever. That's an inside joke. And you were consuming much more fall ball content more than anyone else out there. I just want like 2 or 3 big takeaways for this upcoming 2024 season that you saw on your road trips.
Yeah, cool. Thank you. So I got to visit in person Syracuse, Hobart, Penn State, Cornell, Rutgers, and Princeton. Number one, coaching is a young man's game. It was wild. Particularly John Odierno taking over for Dave Petromala as defensive coordinator at Syracuse, joining Pat March. They're working under Gary Gate. Went to Hobart, relatively old staff in terms of, you know, two guys who are 2-3 years older than me, high school, college friends, in Stephen Brundage and Greg Raymond. Go to Cornell. I mean, they're all like 28 or whatever, doing an incredible job. And then, you know, I've had this conversation with Jeff Tamburoni a few times just in terms of, you know, kind of the youth cycle of assistance through your staff. And then, you know, like I said, that kind of persisted on as just a little bit of a theme that I felt over the course of my travels. You know, beyond that, I'm always interested in how staffs try to reduce the amount of time that players are standing around and watching and increase the amount of time that they're hiding cardio and instilling concepts, whether they be feel or whether that be tactical awareness and understanding, kind of what we were talking about before in terms of developing familiarity with your teammates, having a higher level of anticipation for what he's going to do when confronted with a particular situation and what you should do as a result. You know, if the ball's in your stick, where's he going to cut and what direction do you have to be able to throw the ball to get to him? And if the ball's not in your stick, where's he going to cut? Where's he going to dodge? And how are you going to mirror him in order to be able to be an open passing lane? Or how are you going to try to drag somebody through on the backside? So all of those things are interesting. And what I found was like everybody has a different approach. You know, Hobart had 2 sessions in practice effectively for a 60-minute session. They did half offense, half defense, 6-on-0 at one end, basically banana curls running the clear at the other end for 15 minutes. And then for 45 minutes, they were just 10-on-10 end to end the whole time. It was crazy. Conversely,
ooh, that's a marathon.
It was insane. Yeah. It was insane. Now, granted, it was the full bench, so, you know, it was whatever. You had a fair amount of time to catch your wind when you came off, but still, I mean, you know, for 45 minutes. So then, you know, conversely, Syracuse was all one end of the field, and I wasn't there for the full part of practice because my flight was delayed. Thanks a lot. But yeah, you know, it was just really interesting in terms of the way in which they were kind of getting in and out of particular drills. So that's the second observation. And then the third observation is just the rate of increase in terms of basically how to keep guys fresh in injury prevention, right? And Penn State was probably the biggest example of this because of, I don't know if I have the specifics right, but I'm pretty sure they don't practice more than 3 days in a row, or they don't compete more than 3 days in a row. So basically every fourth day is a full recovery day. Like, and that's just not something that Tambo says he would have done, you know, 5 years ago or even more recently. And it's just a function of the rate of increase and acceptance of sports science and everything that goes along with it. You know, it's one thing for that to be present in the spring when you're competing every seventh day and the results actually count, but to be committed to it in the fall, when you have, you know, basically from whenever guys go home, either after Thanksgiving, if you're on quarters, or after, you know, December 10th or 15th, if you're on semesters, and then come back in early January or mid-January to get things started for real. And it's like, all right, whatever terrible things we do to them for these 3 months, they're at least going to have that month to recover and get fat. And then we're going to have to do it all over again for the first 2 weeks that they're back in January. No, that wasn't it. And it was crazy. And it was an incredible display.
You know, it's just, it just seems all for naught, really, because Notre Dame's going to win the national championship. And, you know, it's nice to be able to know that you're trying to play for second place, but, you know, come playoff time, if you're on the wrong side of the bracket, I don't care about your practice structure, your coaches, your this, your that, you're done. Joking aside, I would love, and maybe we can coordinate this sometime, but maybe even with like a Dave Cottle, somebody who's been around the game for long enough, or, you know, a Corrigan or a Danowski versus, you know, pick any member of the Cornell staff. What has the evolution of practice been like? Like, what did practice actually look like in the 70s, 80s, 90s,
totally,
all the way up to today? Because I remember when, you know, I do a lot of coaching, whether it's youth, whether it's high school. And I've had to revisit because what I was doing was just kind of coming right out of college and then replicating those college game plans. Because I'm like, they've thought about it. They know better than I do. And I realized that, just like you called out, upon reflection, there was more downtime than I think would have, than, you know, upon reflection, every practice was jam-packed. You were learning so much. You were doing this. You were doing that. But a lot of it was, hey, here's what we're going to be doing, this and that, as opposed to the 45 minutes of just up and down, which I would argue is going to be substantially more beneficial than consistent chalk talks. So I don't know. I just think that's a topic that fascinates me, and how practice has evolved and rule changes and shot clocks and all this stuff. Maybe get like an old time geezer coach to come out and teach the young bucks.
For sure. I mean, it's actually a point well taken relative to my visit to Syracuse, because, you know, I was there in the fall of either 2018 or 19, and, you know, Kevin Donahue was, I think, the, I don't really even know how to describe it. Like, I think for a lot of folks that were around the program for a really long time, like John Desko was the guy that made the trains run on time. Roy Simmons was kind of like the heart and the guy that everybody loved. And Kevin Donahue was kind of like the lacrosse brain. And that's being a little bit, you know, kind of unflattering toward John Desko. He knows more about lacrosse than I'll ever know. So I don't want to take away any of the things that he accomplished or the contribution that he made. But just on, like, if you're trying to put people in boxes, that was, I think, the way that the whatever. And I remember, you know, seeing Kevin having a whiteboard literally on the field and drawing for the benefit of all the players that were there. And I remember talking to coaches about it after I saw it. I was like, I don't really recall ever seeing a whiteboard on the field. Not like a handheld, like a full, like, classroom-sized yeah. whiteboard. And I just found it really interesting. And there were some guys that just had so much disdain for it. Like, if you need to draw on a whiteboard during practice, like, you're doing something wrong. And then there are other guys who are like, huh, maybe I'll do that. So it's just, you know, I think that it's a really good example of there are more than one way to skin the cat. Oh, what's that expression all about? That's weird. I don't want to.
I don't know, but Coach Corrigan says it. You know, you don't want to make the sausage. There's more than one ways to skin a cat, and I'm like, what's up with you and killing animals? Like, everything okay?
Well, you know, you said that we're supposed to be living in caves hunting buffalo, so maybe he just is a little bit more in tune with his human nature than you gave him credit for.
I hope so. I'd love to go. I mean, hey,
you
Terry,
want to get in a tree stand with Coach Corrigan?
No, tree stands are cheating. I want to be walking mic'd up with rifles through the mountains, hunting interviews, which is so counterintuitive because you need to be quiet hunting. So maybe we call it unsuccessful hunting interviews.
Okay, yes. I actually have one. So me and Mike Gilbert, who's worked in Inside Lacrosse forever, went to the Eastern Shore of Maryland with Brennan Mundorf to... he was, you know, this is like when he was the best player in the world, and yeah. He didn't care about anything other than hunting. So we went goose or geese hunting. I am not a hunter. I'm also not
a
hunter interviewer.
Hey, while the men hunt, Terry, why don't you go get us some berries? Me and Mundorf are going to bring back the meat.
So the point is, it was so cold that the camera that I brought in order to take photos, like, the battery just disintegrated, and we got no content out of it. So I woke up at like 4 o'clock in the morning in order to be able to get out to the Eastern Shore on time. Didn't shoot a gun while everybody else did. Carried a bunch of geese back to the truck, and then just went home. That was it. That was the entirety of my morning. And I was like, all right, this was worth it, I guess.
Why didn't you pull Trig?
Just wasn't ready, man.
Oh man, come on out to Idaho. Why don't you
maybe do I'm ready now. This kind of looks like I should be a hunter. This reminds me of what Vince Vaughn wears in Wedding Crashers when he gets shot in the ass with the shotgun.
Yeah. Oh man, but yeah, more than welcome to come out to Idaho. I can give you the full rundown on the recruiting landscape.
Well,
here.
What we can do is do an ammunition inventory in order to satisfy Steve and see whether or not you're up to snuff.
We will. You want me to bring the computer out and we can get final thoughts from Steve before wrapping up?
I do, but before we do that, I want to say that you're on the hunt for a new co-host for your other podcast, The Post Game, which comes after The Tailgate. And I volunteered my services, and you said the nicest thing that anybody has said to me in a really long time, if not ever, which is that I don't drink enough to be on The Post Game. Nick, if you knew how much I drank and you said that, that would just be so relieving for my mental and liver pressure, especially heading into the holiday season.
Well, I've seen you in some social cocktail settings, and it's been you and then my broadcast partner, Cooper Perkins, and then me. I like this because there's some good back and forth. You're the intelligent one. I'm the funny, handsome one, freak athlete too. But what the post game is supposed to be is two idiots who somehow achieved a level of lacrosse success, essentially going back and forth. You're looking for a chess match. I'm looking for two rams butting their heads against each other before falling off of a cliff. I think you are too intelligent for what I'm looking for, because every time it's you and Cooper and me sitting down, you and Cooper talking smart, and then I go, "Hey guys, I have a fart joke that you guys should really listen to." And you're like, "Yeah, yeah, we're talking about smart stuff," and I'm like, "Wasn't that funny?" So, congratulations on not being overqualified to be a co-host of The Post Game.
Well, I just want to make sure that we get live updates as to how the search goes.
I recorded episode one just before hopping on here.
Oh wow, how'd it go?
Hartford grad, Canadian. Don't really like recording with Canadians, so I think I'm going to try out a couple co-hosts as soon as we got done recording. Love you if you're listening to this, but I was like, Evan, will you come back and make a post game with me? But, I mean, it's tough. He's got a full-time job. He's got a fiance now, so.
All right. Let's go say hi to Steve.
The search continues. And then if he doesn't come up with something great, then we can just cut it out. So we'll put him on the spot. Steve?
Yeah?
I'm with Terry Foy, and we're wrapping up the episode, and we wanted to give you a chance to give the people the last word.
Hey, Terry.
What's up, Steve?
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good.
I'm really nervous about how much hair is on this podcast right now.
Yeah.
Not a hell of a lot.
Who you got winning the national championship in 2024?
Andy.
And
that was shocking news.
This is going to be released on Christmas morning. A message to the people about spreading Christmas joy.
A message to the people about spreading Christmas joy. Well, just love everybody in your family. Love even the people you don't like. And just make it a big old love fest. That's Christmas joy.
What about Joe Biden?
Yeah, I'm going to take a pass on that one.
Okay. All right. And that's it. And this is his dog, Sugo. And
how many fishes are going to get eaten in the Ostello household over the course of the next 3 days?
How many what?
Fishes.
Oh, we don't do the seven 12? Fishes.
Seven?
We're meat eaters here.
We're meat eaters. Final point for me and my girlfriend. This has just gone off the rails. Got the Christmas roast. Instead of seven fishes, this is what Dom and I will be eating. A Christmas roast, something that I couldn't afford 2 years ago. I hope everybody's bread and mentals are great. I hope you have a very Merry Christmas. If you don't celebrate Christmas, have a great time. And I love you all. And Terry, I love you as well.
Merry Christmas, Terry.
Love you more, Nick.
Love you, Steve.
Oh.